Hey, Anna. First astronaut in space, Yuri Gagarin. He has a big night. In fact, every April 12th is Yuri's night to celebrate his first flight through space.
That's nice.
So, I mean, he went up in space 1961 before any of the American astronauts, circled the Earth and everything.
Yeah.
And so every April 12th, we kind of celebrate space flight and all this. So would you go up in space? What do you think?
No. I can barely fly in a commercial airplane. I need two glasses of wine beforehand and... an eye mask.
You might have something to this because, I mean, Yuri, when he went up into space, he circles around the Earth, then he lands, but he doesn't land in the right place. He landed 100 miles off course.
Oh, my God. How did they find him?
Well, it took him a while, and so he lands in this field, and the first person he sees is a farmer who, unbeknownst to him, is, just out there, and this thing falls from the sky.
Did they know that the Soviet Union was trying to do this?
No. So this, it's landing in this rural part of Russia, and he steps out of the capsule with his orange spacesuit on, dragging a parachute behind him, and he comes up to the farmer trying to explain that he's not a spaceman, that he's like, I'm a Soviet citizen like you, comrade. Can you please give me a phone so I can call Moscow? That is how they found
him. Are you serious?
Yes. The first man in space.
He was like, I'm sitting here on this farm.
Yes.
They're suspicious of me.
But imagine you've never even heard of the space program.
And you blew the landing.
And
right.
This guy comes out with an orange suit with this helmet he's carrying and
man. It had to be terrifying, actually.
I would think that, he would get his gun, if this was in rural Ohio. This is what you would do.
At least have a pitchfork on him.
Something like that.
Just in case he got squirrely.
Welcome back to Earth, Yuri. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman. We are both from the Cincinnati Observatory, where Dean is the astronomer, and I have a need to know the truth. In this episode, we continue our Women's History Month celebration by talking with toxicology specialist Valerie Ryder from NASA's Johnson Space Center. Oh, man. I say poor Yuri, but it all worked out.
No, it worked out. He got back to Russia. He got back to Moscow. He became a hero.
He's at a night 50 years later, 60 years later.
Every year. I mean, yeah, it was an amazing feat. But it kind of talks about how sketchy space travel was in the early days.
Yeah, I mean, that is terrifying. We blew the landing by 100 miles?
Yeah, so way off.
We were way off. Our bad, Yuri.
I know.
I bet they were like... Sorry, bud.
Well, so this leads to some other kind of things that they adapted to the Soviet space program because the landing spots, I mean, the Americans landed in the ocean. But
still scary.
Still scary.
But yeah.
But so the Soviets, their kind of flight path brought them over to rural parts of Russia. And so they decided that they needed to start bringing guns with them. Up to space, which I read about this. I was like, why would you need a gun in space? And it wasn't for being in space. It was for when they landed. And so they would be packing heat when they get out and land because who knows what's going to be there. Is it going to be friendly people? Is it going to be unfriendly people? Is it going to
be a bear?
Could it? And then that is the most likely thing. You got to defend yourself against wild creatures and until you get saved.
Can you imagine that, though? You go up to space. That's the dangerous... What is it? The 60s?
Yes.
Super dangerous.
Yes.
And you come back and you get mauled by a bear.
Exactly.
It's not funny, but it never happens. I can make a joke
about it. Yeah, you open up the door and you're like, this is one small step, and then claw.
Yeah. And then
claw
gets...
That's it.
And a bear is like, quiet.
That's right.
Snack.
That's right.
Oh, man.
So...
That's funny.
It just gets stranger and stranger because
that is strange.
This had to come into play, actually, because another Soviet spacecraft, they go up into space, they come down, they fall off course, and they had to spend 2 days in the woods before they were rescued. So they're sitting there day one. They just slept in the capsule because nobody's going to – they're like, I wonder if somebody will find us. I guess
we're hard to miss.
I guess we better just sit in the capsule and wait.
Giant
capsule.
So then
the second day, some skiers come by, and they share some food and everything like that, and the skiers stay with them until to make sure everything's good. Until then, day three, they finally get rescued.
Oh my God.
But imagine that, going up in space, and then you're nobody's there to pick you up.
You know, nobody's there to pick you up. You're like, hey, guys, anybody?
Mom, dad?
Anybody?
We had practice today.
That's right. This actually reminds me of the fact that I was actually,
No, I want to hear this.
On my wedding, my husband and I were, my parents left. Mike's family leaves. They left us at our own wedding reception. Us like an hour to get home. We had to get a cab to come and get us. That's what it reminds me of. I'm in my wedding dress. I have like a vision. And I had to get in a cab.
Wow.
And the cab driver let me ride up front. He was like, you've had enough. You've been left on your own. I'm just saying.
That makes it memorable.
It did make it memorable. Some of our friends stayed with us.
Oh, that's good.
It was nice.
What's even more surprising is your parents call you every 10 minutes.
They do. Dean is absolutely right.
Where were they?
Yeah, they were like, we're out. Anyway,
saying. Back to space.
It brought back the memories of you're just like, hello, where is everybody? And you're expecting a triumphant return, I bet.
Right.
Like, I'm here. I did it.
Now, and so some other kind of fun little anecdotes from space travel, because, you know, we're going to be talking about space food. We're going to talk about air. So one of the American space astronauts thought it would be fun if he smuggled some food on the rocket, because space food back then was notoriously bad. And so
what would you smuggle?
They're in their full suit. They're sitting there in the spacecraft. And all of a sudden he pulls out a sandwich. From his, I don't know where he stored it, but somewhere. He has a sandwich, and he's like, takes a bite, and they hands it to the astronaut next to him. He takes a bite, and they're like chewing it, and NASA gets super mad.
They're getting ready to take off?
Yeah, they're like, where'd you guys get that sandwich? He's like,
What sandwich?
So when they get back, they get chewed out. You cannot bring any extra food on there, because food is not, you know, this might not be approved food. It might start floating around in the
cabin.
Mess up the instruments, mess up all the stuff. So that was the one and only smuggled sandwich.
Man.
But I got an even better one.
Oh my God, what?
So back to the Soviet space program. One of the astronauts is up in space, and he finds a box in there that he didn't know about. You know, they go through all this training, and all of a sudden there's this box in there, and it's from his wife.
Aww.
She smuggled on a box of chocolates for him. And so he reads the note, and it's like, oh my gosh, that's so nice. And they're floating in space. And then he opens up the box, and then the chocolates just fly everywhere.
Oh my God.
So they're all over there. And of course, it's like, you know, they're floating, the chocolates are floating. It's like, in some ways, it's kind of fun, because you're floating and then you're eating something that's floating.
Yeah.
So it's coming by. And so the official report said it took them 2 hours to clean them up.
Seriously?
Which means 2 hours to eat them.
Eat the evidence.
Let's just go right through that.
Oh, she was trying to be sweet, though.
I know.
She was like, here you go, honey.
So if you could smuggle anything on board a spacecraft, what would be the one thing you'd want?
Oh, my God, one thing?
All you get's one. That's all you get.
I mean, like, I would say, like, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm probably going to say, like, my phone, but I probably don't get service.
They'd hook you up. I mean, you can make phone calls from a space station.
That's right. Because then I could play games if I got tired of people. Right. I could make a phone call.
Yep.
I could look up things on the internet.
Yep.
I mean, that's a cop-out answer, but what about you?
I would go with chocolate. I think that's what I would
Not
go.
Doritos?
Ooh, Doritos.
Dean loves Doritos, everybody.
That would be tough, too. They would fly everywhere.
Food-wise, that's tricky, though. What would you take
food-wise? That would be a dream to be floating and eating Doritos at the same time. Eating floating Doritos. I got a good vision of that in my head now.
That would be pretty, like...
Regular Doritos are just...
I was going to say, so boring. Would you do Cool Ranch or regular?
They're both good.
You're like, I'm not picky. Yeah, whatever I can smuggle in my suit.
Whatever. Yeah, I'll be walking up to the thing. I'll be crunching. They'd be like... Astronaut Regas, do you have something in your pocket?
Everything good over there?
What? Nothing. That's nothing.
No, I'm a little creaky.
Oh, my bones.
I'm so nervous. Sorry. Just creaking on up here.
So, oh, and then the final question I had for you, this is, because this is riveting, is so where would, so if you landed off course, if you did not land where you're supposed to, where on earth would you accidentally like to be a crash land?
Okay, I would like to be, after being in space, right?
Right, you're after in space. You can land anywhere on Earth.
I would like to land directly on, I would say, Hanama Bay, Hawaii. Ooh. I just want to land and then, like, put my hands back and, like, cut off my parachute and just, like, start suntanning. Like, ah, this is great, guys. I love vacation.
Wow, that's
I worked really good. Hard up in space.
That's pretty good. I was going to say Tahiti, but I think that's even better because I think that's a nice island, warm, beautiful weather.
It would be really fun. I would also opt for potentially being dropped in the middle of the Champs-Élysées and buy myself something fancy.
Oh, there you go.
I worked really hard in space. Yeah. Again, theoretical me. Worked very difficult. Right. I know I should say, like, I should want to drop down and see my family, but I'll get to them.
Oh, yeah.
But if I'm going to be dropped anywhere,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. If your family would pick you up, that is.
That's right.
They'll leave
you. They'll leave without me.
They'll be like,
past evidence says,
where's Anna?
That's right. That's nice.
Well, today's guest is Valerie Ryder, and she was suggested to us by one of our listeners, so keep the suggestions coming. We love getting these. Valerie is the toxicology lead at NASA's Johnson Space Center, working to ensure the air and water safety of the women and men serving on the International Space Station and other space flights. Valerie, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to do it.
Well, so in your job, you have some, I mean, this is on my mind. If I want to fly through space, I want to be comfortable. I want to not die. But most importantly, I want to be well fed. What can you tell me about like astronaut food and, you know, what it's like to have, what are their diets like when they're up in space?
Well, that's not actually my area of expertise. However, I am fortunate to have an opportunity to taste some of the food that they are preparing for the astronauts. So I think a lot of folks think about the old Apollo days, and you might go through a museum and see a lot of the freeze-dried, shrink-wrapped food that doesn't look very tasty. The crew actually have pretty normal diets and of international flair because we have several folks who are from all different countries and we try to accommodate as best we can their tastes and desires. And we have a whole team here at Johnson Space Center that does nothing but work on food development, and they offer panel tastings to try to get people's opinions. There's certainly things that we need to think about in terms of keeping them at a particular level of nutrition and ensuring that they don't have high salt in their diets because we have some issues with fluid shifts and changes that are due to spaceflight that we want to make sure that we don't exacerbate. But pretty much we give them a pretty normal diet. And I worked with someone who flew as a payload specialist during the shuttle days, and he said one of his favorite things to eat was a shrimp cocktail. So it's pretty normal food.
Well, that's really funny. Do you have a favorite from all your testing you've done? What's your favorite space food?
Yeah, so I actually got to spend a week in a ground-based analog here at Johnson called Hera, and during that time we ate nothing but the food that they fly on orbit. And I think actually one of my favorite things was basically a chicken noodle soup mixture. And so you inject a hot water into it, and it's really quite tasty. I think that was one of the team's favorite things overall.
Oh, nice. So you work in toxicology, and so, of course, we're wanting to know, how do you keep the air clean and safe for the astronauts when they're on the space station?
Well, we do a lot of things. So we first set guidelines for limits of different contaminants in the air so that folks know what levels we are targeting and what levels we want to maintain in order to keep crew safe. So that's one thing that my team does, is establish those limits. And we do that in ways that are very similar to methods that are used by the Environmental Protection Agency and OSHA and other places. Only I have a unique population of folks, right? I don't have to protect the elderly or children or people with pre-existing health conditions. I have a pretty healthy adult population, some superstars, really. But they are experiencing microgravity, and they are having bone loss and different physiological changes. So if I have a chemical that impacts those particular endpoints that are already affected by microgravity, they might actually be more sensitive than folks on the ground. So in some ways, it's easier to protect the crew, and in some ways, we have to worry about them a little bit more than we have to worry about folks on the ground. So one way that we do that is to set those limits. The next thing that we do is evaluate the different types of chemicals that are planned for flight, so that we can give the crew a warning about the hazards that are associated with those things. Now we work with safety to ensure that those things are designed appropriately and they should never be released into the cabin. But if they are, then the crew knows how to deal with that and they have the appropriate gloves and masks and things to address that and to clean it up. And then to make sure that we're meeting our limits and that those things aren't escaping, we have a whole suite of monitoring equipment so that we can actually evaluate the air and the water and make sure that what they're breathing and drinking is below those limits that we have set. So we have a laboratory here who helps prepare that hardware for flight. And then we perform the analysis, and then my team actually evaluates those relative to the limits we set. And we put out reports that tell the crew, here's what you were exposed to, and here's what you can expect might be the consequence of that. Now, luckily, the levels of contaminants on the space station are very, very low. It's much cleaner than the air here in Houston. They're breathing during training. And we have a very specific material selection. We have filters that have both filtration for dust and microbes and that kind of thing, but also charcoal that can remove odors and various gaseous contaminants. So it's actually really quite clean air. And water as well. I know that that's one that's of interest to folks because we recycle everything.
Well, that was my next question. And it's a touchy subject, but I've heard this rumor that the water is recycled from a certain source.
Could
you tell us about that?
The astronauts love to say that yesterday's coffee becomes tomorrow's coffee. We do recycle everything. We recycle urine as well as the humidity that condenses in the cabin environment, and we process that through a series of filtration systems, and then we treat it with antimicrobial agents, and the crew do recycle and drink that water. And again, it's very clean and pure, and we do perform testing to confirm that what they're drinking has been appropriately filtered. So they have no issues with it, and they say that it tastes quite good.
Oh, I'm sure it does. I'm sure it's fine. I mean, it's cool.
It's just the mental thought, right?
Right. I got to get over the mental hump of that. But
very closed circuit. Yeah, it's just a little too much.
Yes.
<Close circuit.
laughs>
So we were joking a little bit when we first got on with you that, you know, there's no typical day, so I won't ask you what a typical day is like for you, but can you give us an example of what you might do in a day, if that's sort of another way to ask that question of kind of what your job looks like?
Well, there are times when we need to discuss with the program a particular hazard and weigh the pros and cons, the benefits. So, you know, ISS is a scientific platform. The goal of that is a national laboratory. So we want to perform science, but we need to balance that with crew safety. And so there are often discussions that I have with management to talk about, here's the hazard to the crew, but here's the benefit of utilizing that particular chemical in order to get a scientific benefit, and how do we make sure that we are as safe as possible? How do we design the hardware? How do we design procedures? And how do we make sure that the crew are appropriately informed so that they can perform that science effectively but safely? And so that's really ultimately our goal and what we do on a daily basis. I spend a lot of my time enabling things and trying to make sure that the policies and procedures are in place so that my team, who actually does the lion's share of the work and the technical assessments, can do their job and do it well.
Well, this has been fascinating. Thanks for mentioning the water. We had to talk about that and the air and the food. And this has been a real pleasure, Valerie. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
All right, we're going to do a little kid question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, we know our age on this planet.
Yes.
How old would we be on other planets?
Mm.
Same age, different age, older, younger, ideally younger. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really popular kid question. Mm-hmm. They love to know how old they are on other worlds.
And how much they'd weigh.
Yeah, I think those are the two things. It's like, you know, because you have your birthday every year because you're celebrating another trip around the sun.
Right.
So that's what one year is on Earth, but the trips around the sun are different from different planets.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, as if you picture yourself like a 12-year-old, you just, I don't know, you always think it's so cool that if you're a different age or something like that.
Yeah, that's true.
They always like to want to envision themselves. And so they look at me and I come in and to me, I'm 130 years old. But in actuality, and so I do give that joke, like when I'm in a classroom and they're like, you know, if you're 11, you've been around the sun 11 times. If you're 12, you've been around the sun 12. If you're a teacher over there, if you're her, you've been around the sun 85 times.
Oh, are you serious?
I always do that.
Oh, man.
I know. The teacher,
you couldn't do yourself? You'd be like,
Sometimes
like,
I
no.
do myself. And
I have to be cool.
I wait for a reaction. Sometimes they're like, no. And sometimes they're like,
that seems low.
Seems about right. Seems about
is
right.
Is that it? Sometimes. 85?
Yeah. So.
Yes.
Every planet has its own different age. So for Mercury, it takes 88 days to go around the sun. So
oof.
1 year on Mercury is only 88 days. So you take your own age here on Earth, multiply by 4, and that's a pretty close estimate. So
it's about how old I feel in Earth years.
Yeah, and I remember this one because my buddy James Albury from down in Florida celebrated. Sorry, James, your 200th Mercury birthday. I mean, he celebrated.
Everyone's doing math right now, like to carry the 4.
And that was a while ago.
Oh,
too.
Snap!
And so when I read that, I was like, good Lord, James is 200 on Mercury? And then I looked at myself and like, ooh,
I was gonna say,
getting close.
Are you that much?
Getting close, James.
Uh-huh.
So that puts you up there. Venus is, you're going to be pretty old on Venus. A whole year on Venus, about 225 days. So take your own age and multiply by about like 1.5, something like that.
It's like converting kilometers to miles.
Yeah. So it's similar. It's
not that
it's,
bad.
It's not too bad.
Yeah.
But so then you get to Mars, and this is where it starts getting in your favor because Mars is a lot slower, goes around the sun 687 days.
So okay, it's like half my age.
Yeah, it's almost half. So it's about 60% or so. So that's what we're talking. So
yeah.
So yeah, whenever I talk, like to fifth graders, they're 11. I say, well, on Mars you'd be about 6 or 7, and they're like, they think that's the most hilarious thing. Like,
do they really?
I'd be in kindergarten and that kind of stuff.
Like, that was 5 years ago.
I know, but they think that's the best. So you can totally entertain kids with this,
yeah, I can
because
see that.
They love it. So then they want to know all the rest of them, and the rest of them get a little more tricky because the farther out from the sun, the longer a year is. And so Jupiter takes almost 12 years to go around the sun.
Oh, Lord.
So those fifth graders are pretty much all 0 years old.
They're negative something.
They're negative, yeah. And so, and then Saturn is about 29 and a half years for a one orbit. So
I've barely been around once.
You are barely one on Saturn.
That's right.
And then you get to the outer ones, Uranus, Neptune. Then Uranus is 84 years for one orbit, and Neptune's about 165 years.
165 years for one rotation.
One revolution.
That's teeny tiny too, right?
Well, no, Uranus and Neptune are pretty big.
Oh,
so they are pretty gigantic planets. You're thinking of that non-planet that we're not going
to
mention.
Trying to squeeze it in there.
But for those planets, they're huge, but they take a long time to go around the sun.
They're just slow.
Yeah, and so it was only recently that we even saw an entire Neptune orbit.
Because it's 165 years. Yeah,
because we found it 100 and, what are we up to, about 170 years ago that we found it. So it just finished its first orbit since we've been watching it.
They were like, anytime now, Neptune, bring it on home, buddy.
It completes the circle. We're like, okay, good.
Great. Here we go again.
It is a planet. All right, let's start it up. But I'm telling you, if you're talking to kids and you want to regale them with science facts, tell them how old they are in other worlds. They love it.
That's a parenting tip, kids management tip from Dean Regas. You heard it. Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks very much to Valerie Ryder from NASA's Johnson Space Center for taking the time to be with us.
As I mentioned in her intro, Valerie came to our attention thanks to an email from a listener. So we love your ideas as well. Email us at lookingup@wvxu.org.
The archives of all past episodes of Looking Up are easy to find, and we've had some great guests and topics. So check them all out at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. If that happens to be Apple Podcasts, your rating and comments will help others find us. So, thanks for helping us out. And if you like what you hear, spread the word.
Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer. Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.